Welcome everyone, this Wednesday morning to the Scale Leadership Series. We're joined today by Saurabh Tripathi, the former CFO at Highmark at Fresenius, and the former head of global finance at GE Healthcare. So Saurabh, that's an incredibly impressive resume. And those are very well-known businesses, all three of them. We're gonna start the way we start every leadership series interview, which is if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, your journey through healthcare, and what's led you to here today.
Yeah, good morning, Roy, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to this group. Obviously, a very impressive gathering here. Just a little bit about myself. I've been in finance for 25 years now, most of my career in healthcare, as you said. I started my professional career in England, in Procter & Gamble, and then GE Appliances, and GE Capital, and then came to GE Healthcare back in 2000, and have been part of healthcare since then. Spent about 12 years or so in GE Healthcare, and then came to Fresenius Medical Care, and at Highmark most recently. It's been an incredible journey, and healthcare, as we know, we are all consumers of healthcare. And frankly, it's broken. It's a system that needs a lot of upgrade. So I think that presents a lot of opportunities for all of us to make an impact.
That's great to hear. So, well, at least the part that involves us making an impact, the broken part, not as great. Just taking a step back for a second on the journey that you've traveled, few people have held such senior positions in both a large national payer, a large health system. That's the combination of Highmark being both, really. A large outpatient services business, as I think of Fresenius, focused on the diabetes and kidney care space. And on top of that, one of, if not the largest, med device business at GE. So you've really had a unique top of the mountain perspective on all three very different markets. What do you draw from that perspective? What do you draw from that experience as commonalities and differences between what are considered to be three very distinct markets all within healthcare?
Yeah, that's a great question, Roy. If I could go back to my comment, we are all consumers of healthcare. If you put the patient or the consumer in the center, you'll see the solar system of healthcare revolves around med devices companies. So GE Healthcare, as an example, the companies that make MRIs, CTs, X-rays, and then they sell it to the providers, which is hospitals. And then the hospitals get the reimbursement from insurance companies like Highmark. So the solar system that I'm talking about is med devices manufacturing those products, then providers using those products to provide services to the consumers, and then in turn getting a reimbursement from insurance companies like Highmark. And the economics is really fascinating. And when I think about this dynamic, especially from finance eyes, you know, a lot depends on the contract between the insurance and the provider entities, and then how those provider entities are able to fund or finance those medical devices and the back end. So it's fascinating. It revolves around that solar system, and ultimately the consumer, the patient, ends up paying in some shape or form, whether it is through our insurance premiums or co-pays or otherwise.
So or taxes.
That's how I think about this three-legged entities.
What are the greatest misconceptions that each of these stakeholder groups have about each other? So what do health systems and payers get wrong about the outpatient space? What does the outpatient system or space market get wrong about the med device space? What do they get wrong?
Yeah, another great question, Roy. In my role at Highmark, I had an opportunity to see both sides, provider side as well as the payer side. And I think the greatest misconception is when you think from the provider side, the belief is the payers are not paying us enough. The insurance reimbursement needs to be higher, and the providers would complain all day long on why their rates are lower and they should be paid more. On the payer side, the conception or the misconception is that the providers are inefficient. They have a lot of fixed assets. They need to operate more efficiently. So this back and forth between the two leads to a lot of financial gymnastics. And frankly, in my view, the truth is somewhere in between, where, you know, the providers probably in the post-pandemic era need to be more efficient, need to think about how they are delivering those services and where they are delivering those services. And in turn, the payers need to think about how they are reimbursing some of the services that didn't exist before COVID. For example, digital care, you know, some of those outpatient services, ASC services, they need to think differently on how those reimbursement, you know, things are working.
So building on that and bridging it to your comment about healthcare being broken, if you were in charge of the entire market and you could regulate change by Monday morning, what would you force all the stakeholders to do differently at a practical level? What new regulations would you institute that you think would lead to dramatic improvement addressing the broken aspects of healthcare?
Yeah, Roy, I wish I could do it that quickly. But let me just give one data point to the audience before I answer that question. US economy is roughly 25 trillion, somewhere around that.
Mm-hmm, 26. We're very proud of the 26.
Yep. And healthcare spend is roughly 3 to 4 trillion of that, you know, one fourth of that. Mm-hmm. And you'll see that healthcare spend is growing at 6 to 7% on an annual basis. Mm-hmm. We all know that the US economy is not growing at 6 to 7%. So if you do the math, healthcare is very quickly going to become a big burden, especially Medicare, Medicaid, et cetera, and it's going to be unaffordable in the US economy. So that's my comment on it's broken. You know, what can I do in order to change some of the regulations? In my view, it again comes from the consumers. You know, what's best for the consumer, for the patient? I think me as a consumer, I would like to have least amount of surgical procedures. I would like to have the minimal invasive surgeries and probably less hospital visits for myself. I would like to have more quality or higher quality of care at the least amount of copay or least amount of payment for myself. Mm-hmm. So when you boil down those things, Roy, what it translates to what we now call as value-based care. Mm-hmm. In the past, hospitals or physicians were paid based on number of procedures they were doing, number of scans they're doing, what we call as fee for service. Mm-hmm. Now the environment is shifting towards, forget about the number of scans or number of surgeries, you know, is the patient healthy? Are you keeping the patient out of hospital? Are you keeping the cost of care lower? And if all of those are yes, yes, and yes, that means you are delivering a good quality value to your patients. And the hospitals get paid a fixed amount for doing that, which is what we call value-based care. So as a regulation, I would recommend we mandate that most of the providers need to get on the value-based care, get on the VBR arrangement with the payers, and march towards that.
How much value-based care success did you witness at Highmark? I imagine that Fresenius was probably a little early and GE very early on some of the large spend that's gone into value-based care over the past decade. And maybe I'm wrong about that, so feel free to correct me, but at least at Highmark, I would assume that you saw a lot of momentum in value-based care transition. Do you want to walk us through that?
Yeah, absolutely, Roy. In Highmark, we have a captive health system, Allegheny Health Network, and we were able to move the dial significantly on Allegheny Health Network's reimbursement through value-based care. And I think rough numbers were when we started in 2018 on this journey, we were roughly 30% VBR and 70% fee for service. And in 2023, we flipped it to the other way around, roughly 60% VBR and about 40% fee for service. The challenge is with all the other providers that Highmark contracts with. And I'll give a very simplistic view. You know, as a hospital, I'm used to doing scans, I'm used to doing surgeries, and I'm used to getting paid for it. That's the fee for service model. Now you come in and tell me, don't do scans, unnecessary scans, don't do unnecessary surgeries. Oh, by the way, do those surgeries if you have to in an outpatient setting, not in an inpatient setting. That puts a big question mark on how I have ran my hospital for last 100 years. I need to redesign the infrastructure, the operating rooms, maybe some of the fixed costs that I have. And frankly, that's not easy, Roy. That's a very difficult and time-consuming process. Mm-hmm. So that's why the dial has moved slowly with other providers. But frankly, the writing is on the wall, and those who are embracing it and following it will survive. And those who resist this change, I believe, will become dinosaurs very quickly.
How does Highmark deal with the open network that it functions in relative to a Kaiser closed network of hospitals, outpatient facilities, and members in the context of trying to push into value-based care? I imagine that the Highmark challenge is more complicated.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, it's a good comparison when you think about Kaiser, it's closed system, as you said. So for the audience, if I'm a Kaiser Permanente's insurance member, I can only go to Kaiser's hospitals to get my treatment done. Now, Kaiser is a big system, so obviously they have lots of hospitals and, you know, access is not a problem. But let's say if I'm traveling to a different state, if I'm going to a different location where there isn't a Kaiser hospital, that presents a challenge to me because my insurance may or may not be in network there. What Highmark does is offers both what we call narrow network and broad network. And narrow network is for someone who is resident of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and has access to all the Allegheny Health hospitals. We offer them, you know, insurance, which is quite attractive, and give them those services in our footprint here. But the broad network offers flexibility to our members. Let's say someone wants to travel to a different state or even different country, and they want to be covered with their insurance. You know, Highmark would offer network in those states as well. And, you know, the patients or consumers can be taken care of. The challenge there is, you know, Highmark has to then go out and establish contracts with the hospitals that are not part of Highmark. And that's where the economics comes in. Sometimes those rates may or may not be as attractive as a narrow network insurance premium, but still at least it gives access to our members to all those providers.
Would you say, is it fair to assume that your narrow network performance from a value-based care standpoint is significantly stronger than it is in your broad network?
Absolutely. And in fact, data proves that. You know, the quality of care, the access, the economics are much better in narrow network in Highmark. And that's why we promote narrow network as much as we can. And frankly, Roy, it is super convenient for someone who is, you know, resident of Pennsylvania or Pittsburgh or surrounding areas and doesn't travel much. It is the best insurance premium to have.
Taking a step back from a second and thinking again about all three businesses, looking backwards and looking forwards, what were some of the best strategic partnerships that you saw these very large institutions execute on well across the aisle with other entities? And how does that inform where you think healthcare might go in terms of interesting and value generating strategic partnerships that others can think about replicating going forward?
Yeah, a couple things come to mind, Roy. I think the first and foremost is what we are just talking about, the value-based care in the offerings of capitated payment and then letting the providers manage the care of a patient. And I'll give you a couple examples. You know, typically, some of the older patients or patients with chronic diseases have other morbidities or other comorbidities. What it means is if I'm a high blood pressure patient, I may have diabetes, I may have chronic heart condition, et cetera, et cetera. And all of those conditions may or may not be linked. But if you offer a capitated payment to a provider and say, as an example, I'll pay you, you know, $1,000 a month, you take care of all conditions of this patient, the providers can then wrap around their services around that member and provide services for high blood pressure or, you know, diabetes or chronic heart condition all together and bring down, you know, those diseases in that patient. I think that's probably the biggest impact, you know, value-based care has made, where a patient is treated holistically versus individually for each disease. The second thing I would say is digitization. I'm a big believer in digitization, and frankly, other industries have leapt ahead of us when you think about, you know, banking industry. I don't even know where my bank branch is. You know, I do everything electronic. When you think about shopping, you know, Amazon, when you think about other industries, digitization has leapt far ahead of healthcare. And frankly, pre-COVID, we were all used to going to a hospital, seeing a physician in person, sitting in a waiting chair for half an hour. I think post-COVID, now we are used to having a video call with our physicians, or, you know, for unnecessary hospital visits, you know, we can just take a phone call or do a video call.
And did you start to see some of the shift and the benefits, the cost savings, productivity improvements, access of a virtual footprint while at Highmark or Fresenius?
Absolutely. I think the biggest benefit is you don't need, you know, a dedicated nurse or a dedicated physician assistant to stand by every patient. You know, you can have maybe one nurse attending five or six patients because they are doing virtual calls. The other savings would be eventually you won't need all the fixed assets, the brick and mortar buildings. You can reduce that as well. And, you know, from a patient point of view, it's a huge convenience. You know, I don't have to drive half an hour every day and then go to see my physician, wait in the waiting room. So it's a huge time saving as well. As long as the cost, as long as the care, the quality of care is the same, what you'd encounter when you actually go and see your physician.
I think that's been the challenge in the past, has been consistently attractive reimbursement levels for virtual care and confidence in the actual quality of that care. Do you see a lot of progress on both fronts?
Yeah, actually, one of the good things Highmark did during COVID, we matched the online reimbursement with in-person reimbursement. So if you were doing a video call with a physician, the reimbursement was the same versus if you were going to see a physician in office. The benefit of doing that was it became economically as attractive to the providers to do a video call with the patients as to ask them to come on site. And that shifted the dynamics significantly. I believe the video visits went up something like 4,000%, you know, post-COVID. So I do see the shift happening, but I'll say, Roy, there is a lot more to be done in that space.
Yeah, we've seen some of those regulations from the government, federal government, that were relaxed during COVID that facilitated virtual care return back to pre-COVID levels. that acted as an impediment to virtual care. So I take the point. We're not quite where we were in COVID, where it was green field for virtual care.
Right.
Yeah. But still a lot more virtual care utilization today than where we were in 2019. It still appears to be 2 to 3 times the volumes that we saw before COVID.
Right. And Roy, if I may just add one more point, the biggest risk of going to a hospital is what we call hospital acquired infections. You know, you walk in a hospital and, you know, come out after a day or 2 day stay. Yep. And there are a lot of infections that can be, you can carry out while doing a virtual visit. That risk is almost 100% eliminated.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Sarab, that the days of virtual care representing less than 5% of volumes across a large market like the US are probably long gone. Right. So it will be interesting to see where it nestles out, where it stabilizes. Is it 30%? Is it 50%? Is it 90%? And I think we all have that to learn. And it's also subject to more improvements, right? And more education across the board, not just providers, but patients as well.
Yep.
Absolutely. Going back to your role as the CFO at all three institutions, GE, head of global finance, which of the many businesses that Highmark, Fresenius, and GE were in stay with you as great businesses to be in within healthcare? And which do you look back and say, wow, that business was incredibly difficult, complex, unstable, volatile. What are your favorites and what are your least favorite businesses within healthcare, given that you've seen so many over the years?
That's a tough question to answer, Roy. I would say they're all great in their spaces.
Oh, you're too kind.
But let me...
They're not your children, Sarab. You can be more critical.
But let me share with you, I think Highmark is probably the most complex. And I say that because Highmark has both payer and provider. So you see the economics between the two, and obviously the consumer or the patient is in between from a complexity point of view. And I would say Highmark is embarking on a journey, what we call living health, to simplify that. And I think we have made a lot of progress in the last 4 years, and we are on to something big, something huge in the future. So I would say Highmark certainly is on top of the list. You know, Fresenius, very complex, but mostly on the provider side. On the GE side, I would say what I learned there and what I admire about GE is the global nature of the business. And I'll give you one example. You know, I was CFO of the X-ray modality, and one X-ray machine has 300 parts that ship from 25 different countries to be assembled in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So you can imagine how much complexity you have when you have 25 countries involved in manufacturing one X-ray machine. So a lot of complexity, a lot of globalization. And one other thing I noticed, we are from on devices side, we are competing with some of the most innovative countries like China and India and Brazil, where same equipment can be produced at 1/10 the cost. So it was fascinating to see how those things were working there.
And as the CFO, what do you think about the CFO position within healthcare? How has it changed? How is it misconstrued by non-CFOs within healthcare?
I think CFOs of healthcare have a very tough job. And I'll give you, obviously I'm biased, but I'll give you my perspective. Not only you are managing the finances of the company you're working in, you're also getting slammed by macroeconomic factors. You know, whether it is CMS regulations, whether it's reimbursement from government, whether it's reimbursement from payers. And then on top of that, you have things like rising interest rates or higher inflation, wage costs going up. So you have to be constantly on that hamster wheel, you know, not only looking at the economics of your company, but also watch out for all the macroeconomic factors that might impact your company. So I know I'm biased, but I would say healthcare CFOs have a tougher job than other industrial CFOs. And the second part of your question, you know, how is it misconstrued by non-finance people? I think non-finance people might be thinking, you know, CFO job is to come in, report your numbers, and move on to the next month. Frankly, that's not how I have operated, and that's not how CFOs operate in healthcare. You are not only making sure the numbers are reported right, but you're also looking for risks and opportunities around the corner and what's coming down the pike so you can plan and prepare your organization for that. And COVID was a great example where a lot of healthcare systems went through a very, very tough time. And those CFOs who were proactive, looking down the pike, were very successful, and those who were not, frankly, did not succeed.
Why do you think there's so much turnover in the CFO position within healthcare?
I think part of it is opportunity. And part of it is, if you look at the CFO roles, I would say they are a pressure cooker role. They have a lot going on, whether it is internal reporting, external reporting. So there is only so much runway. And yesterday I was reading a report somewhere, an average S&P 500 CFO's lifespan is roughly 3.5 years. So it's a combination of things. You know, it's a combination of the pressure they are in and also opportunities that present to them.
Yeah, I want to open it up for the rest of the group to ask any questions. Saurabh, I definitely appreciate you answering all of my questions. Anyone feel free to volunteer a question to Saurabh?
I'll start, Roy. This is Carl Friedrich. Thank you for your comments so far. It's been very very enlightening. I think about this topic a lot. You know, when you talk about changing the dynamics of the costs of healthcare, you speak very well about the providers, and you speak very well about the insurance companies. And alignment with the patient is always something that's tricky. And we don't really have a great model for creating an incentive model for the patients beyond taking good care of yourself, which seems obvious, but consumer behavior proves us wrong every day. Any thoughts on what will be evolving in terms of trying to get patients to buy into value-based care as we move from sort of more of a Medicare population into the broader population?
Yeah, Carl, you hit on the nail on the head. This is probably the biggest question that healthcare industry is grappling. And let me offer you this. You might have seen recently there are a lot of acquisitions in the primary care space. You know, CVS acquired Oak Street and another company, Signify Health. Amazon acquired another primary care business. OptumRx is acquiring a lot of physicians. Why are they doing that? Because physician offices are the first door that patients enter into healthcare systems. And what they're trying to do is exactly what you said. If my physician tells me that, look, I have these conditions, I have a high blood pressure, diabetes, I'm on a cusp of getting a heart disease, and I need to change my lifestyle, and I need to do these things. I need to eat right. I need to exercise. I need to take care of myself. And the physician is very engaged with me in offering me those advices and maybe connecting me with a couple of digital tools that might help me do that. I may not develop those diseases down the road, and I may not end up in a hospital. I may not become a big consumer of health down the road. So that's why these companies are getting into the physician offices. And I believe in order to engage patients or consumers, we need to start from the door they enter healthcare system, which is physician offices.
One quick follow-up, thank you. And that is do you see a scenario in which if I go to the doctor and I take better care of myself, that my premiums would go down or I would be incentivized materially? To use a bad analogy, maybe, if I'm a good driver, my insurance goes down. And if I'm a bad driver, my premium goes up. Something along those lines.
I must be a bad driver, Carl, because I can't remember a day where my car insurance went down. I think it only goes up. It's a question of how fast does it go up.
Well, the rate, slow down the slope then, maybe.
That's right.
Yeah, Carl, 1,000% I agree with you. And in fact, the example I gave where CVS is acquiring these companies, guess what? CVS has Aetna insurance company. So the reason why they are getting into the physician offices, because they want to lower the cost of care, so that they can lower their premiums, which you and I pay, and that makes them more competitive. So I'm absolutely certain that if you are a good driver in this case, you can demand a lower premium. You can show your history to your healthcare insurer, and they will be willing to offer you a lower premium insurance. That time is already here. Some insurance companies are offering that, and others are quickly following.
That's going to be a meaningful change in the industry.
Yep.
And that will drive a lot of change in patient behavior, you would think, overnight. So that is a very interesting point. From your perspective, Sarab, who's got it right in terms of the big model, the big synergy model, combining the payer landscape, the payer business model with the provider business model, with the digital model, the pharma model, who's connecting these building blocks correctly and who's on his or her way to learning a very difficult lesson? Is it Walgreens? Is it Walmart? Is it CVS? Is it Amazon? Is it Apple? Who's creating a business model for the future that you think is likely to win out?
Yeah, I think at the present moment, Roy, I don't think anyone has figured it out. And hence the comment, healthcare is broken right now.
I should have probably offered United Optum as well and some of the large health system aggregators out there as well, like Ascension and Kaiser.
Exactly. So at the present moment, nobody's got it right. But every big healthcare company or even non-healthcare companies trying to get into this to fix it. Who's got as close to right? I think CVS and probably United and Optum.
But they're very different, right? CVS has shied away from owning providers, whereas United Optum owns 60,000 of them. So,
well, CVS is acquiring all these physician offices now, you know, through Signify Health and Oak Street, where they paid, you know, tens of billions of dollars for these acquisitions to get into physician offices. Optum, I was surprised to learn that Optum is the biggest physician offices owner in the country. They mm-hmm. own almost like 20% of the total physician population.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So I think between the two, they are definitely making right moves. And I think they will be ahead of others like Amazon and Walmart. I think those two are absolutely getting in the right place.
Yeah, so Walgreens, I don't believe, has made a payer play yet. CVS started on the payer play with Aetna. And then the pharma investment as well. I think that sort of the last shoe to drop there has been the provider shoe.
That's right.
Whereas United started from that perspective and has been migrating up the provider scale rapidly at an incredible pace for years. So you like the combination of payer plus provider. Do you think the retail footprint, traditional retail footprint, driving traffic, knowing traffic, is a critical piece? Can you create a large integrated health platform without owning big box retail stores that sell you pencils and vegetables?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's where the consumerism of healthcare is going. You know, if you think about what Walmart is doing and what CVS is doing with Minute Clinics, they are trying to capture patients when they walk in into their store for blood screening, for blood pressure tests and things like that, and take it from there. So I think that's where the retail part of healthcare is heading. I don't think any of the large traditional companies like CVS or Optum or Amazon would ever want to own a big provider system, because I can tell you from my experience, provider systems are huge capital commitment. I mean, you're talking of billions of dollars of assets that you have to do.
Do you think that they will stay away from anything inpatient while they still build meaningful scale in outpatient?
Absolutely.
And the more virtual outpatient gets, the happier they'll be.
Exactly.
And what keeps them away is the fixed asset component.
That's right. Fixed asset. And it's not just a one-time fixed asset. You know, you got to keep your facilities state of art. You know, you got to buy new MRIs and CTs. So there's a lot of cost involved in owning big box providers. And I think that's why these companies will shy away from it.
I mean, commercial real estate really has a lot to worry about. You've seen the death of retail, now the death of office. And we're describing a contraction in healthcare retail footprint as well. You sort of run out of ideas. All you're left with is residential. Okay, any more questions from the group? For Saurabh?
Yes, good morning, Saurabh. Melissa Kwiatkowski here. Good to hear your voice.
Hi, Melissa.
And hi, I have two questions for you. The first one, since we're talking about acquisition of primary care, that is your front door. I recently attended a conference and a statistic was shared there that upon acquisition of a physician practice, this was around the health systems acquiring them, that costs go up within the next year around 20%. So if these big box stores are in the acquisition mode, how are they going to acquire them and keep costs down is my first question.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, Melissa. It is going to present a challenge where the cost is initially going to go up. What they have to do is think about their operating model differently. You know, how are they going to provide the services that were being done inpatient in an outpatient setting? And I'll give you a few examples. Can we do knee surgery or hip surgery or some of these optional surgeries in an outpatient setting? Not just do it in outpatient setting, but do it at a lower cost than what we were doing in inpatient setting. And therein lies the challenge. You know, how do you bring in your cost down? How do you do more of these in a outpatient setting so your reimbursement is higher, but your cost of operations is lower? That's the shift these hospitals are facing. I don't think it's going to happen overnight, but it is going to happen. It's just a matter of time. The second thing I'll say, Melissa, unless they figure this out, the payers are actually forcing them to figure this out. Because I know the reimbursement landscape is changing, where some of the payers are paying a lower rate of reimbursement for inpatient surgeries or making them as an outpatient right away. So hospitals don't really have a choice. They have to take these cases in an outpatient setting.
Thank you. The second question I have is around specialists. So when you think about you have the primary care physicians and the specialists. Specialists are very late to the game at this point when it comes to value-based care. You see a couple bundle programs out there, orthopedics, oncology, OB, but can you shed some light on where you think this is going from a specialist and how we can get this to align? Because I'll tell you, the primary care physicians that I'm talking to feel that the weight of the world of value-based care rests on their shoulders.
Yeah, absolutely, Melissa. I'll go back to my Fresenius days. So a chronic kidney disease patient or a diabetic patient may end up in a dialysis situation. And there are, you know, stages before they end up in a dialysis situation. There are five stages of diabetes. So in a specialist, the way Fresenius was operating in a specialist setting, if you are signing up a value-based reimbursement and you have a capitated payment, and let's say the capitated payment is $1,000 a month, the incentive for Fresenius specialist is to keep those patients out of dialysis. Because if they keep them out of dialysis, they will have lower cost of care. And not only the primary care physician wins, but also the specialists win because, you know, their bonuses are aligned to the cost of care, et cetera. So I would say certain disease states are aligning faster than others. And CKD is one of them. But there are a few others where, let's say, chronic heart failure or neurological diseases where specialists are still further far from the value-based care.
Thank you.
Any more questions for Saurabh?
Yes, this Dr. Jan Katznelson, have two questions. Piggyback on actually on the previous two questions. One is about the increased inefficiency, despite very good ideas, why to bring so many primary care and professional specialists to the hospital networks. Increased inefficiency and cost create this kind of loss leader that leads to mounting losses. So the question is about this, whether there's opportunity for management companies to manage the whole kind of faculty, this hospital-owned physicians, instead of physicians just outsourcing emergency medicine or radiology or hospitalists. Whether there are any companies or a room for one management company to manage all physicians together and whether hospitals will give it to them.
Yeah, absolutely. So if I understand your question, you know, what those management companies can do to run these physician offices efficiently.
Correct, all together. So to make sure that not it works well with the hospitals, it works very well between different specialties, kind of under one roof.
Exactly. So I would point to a couple of places. In my experience, when you think about the journey of a patient from a primary care to a specialist to a hospital, there's a lot of paperwork. There's a lot of manual work. There's a lot of care coordination that needs to happen. And today, you know, some of the statistics is, you know, a typical nurse spends 2/3 of their time on paperwork and 1/3 of their time on actual clinical care. So if I'm a physician management office, I would look at opportunities to streamline those, digitize as much paperwork as we can, use artificial intelligence, and AI is, you know, quickly becoming, you know, very popular in healthcare, and then care coordination. So when a patient goes from a primary care to a specialist to a hospital, is the data traveling with that patient? And can we take out some of those inefficiencies, process inefficiencies, as well as cost inefficiencies out of the system so that we spend less time and less dollars in taking care of those patients?
Saurabh, let's assume the system like this exists. We spend close to $100 million to developing software with 100 software engineers over 12 years. Who will be the best person in organization and insurance company that we can present and people can evaluate whether this continuity of care? Basically, every decision for every role in real time will be correct decision, will be suggested based on the patient information and medical and insurance and institutional guidelines. Who can look at this and say, okay, that's what we need, let's do it?
Great question. I would say, obviously, the CFO of the insurance company would be very interested because I can tell you from my seat, we are always looking for opportunities to save cost. The actuarial team, whether it's chief actuary or data analytics officer, would be another one, because they are also looking for opportunities to reduce their medical loss ratio, which is basically the cost of care. And you know, from there you can go on to the higher rungs of the management. But I think pitching to the chief data officer or chief actuary and the CFO would be the right place to start.
Right. Next question related to specialists. Specialty care, I read in a few places that specialty care is more contributing to cost of care even than primary care. And if we, so the question is whether it's possible, for example, a condition called fibroids, and it's 50 to 80% of women suffer from this condition. And the cost of care for this common condition can be well above $100,000 between fertility treatments, blood, hormones, iron, myomectomy, hysterectomy, and everything. So the alternatives exist, like uterine fibroid embolization, which is approximately $8,000 to $10,000 outpatient procedure, takes, 30, 40 minutes to do. And after that, with 98, 99% probability, patient will not need any of this, and it can be done earlier. Now, the decisions are left for patients, for doctors, for gynecologists, for everyone to do whatever they want. So my question is it possible for insurance company to analyze this condition or similar condition and design, okay, that's the desirable pathway that's good for the patient and extremely cost efficient, just to eliminate, cure the problem rather than caring for them? And yes, it's a little less democratic because, you know, you decide what's the best, but and then incentivize, first regulate, say this is right, this is wrong, and also incentivize patient and doctors just to do the right things through prior authorizations, co-pays, and other things. Well, that's something you might be interested, or other insurance company might be interested to, condition by condition, think about cure, that 10x decrease of cost of care rather than just let everyone to do whatever they want.
Yeah, great question, Doc. And in fact, that's exactly what Highmark is doing in the living health strategy I mentioned earlier. You know, we have 8 or 10 most popular conditions or chronic conditions, whether it is CHF or COPD or CKD, et cetera. And our in-house doctors have established what is the least expensive, most effective, highest quality pathway of care. And we are calling it curated model. So that's the suggested model of care. And then they are offering those to the entire provider network, all the physicians, all the specialists. Then if patient shows up with COPD or CHF or CKD, you know, here are the standard procedures to follow. And then what we are doing is we are analyzing those doctors over a period of time. And what you find is, obviously, let's say if you're looking at 100 specialists, 95 of them are following that curated model, 5 of them are not. And if they are not over a consistent period of time, then there is a medical office outreach to them to understand why is that. And in some cases, we found that it could be just physician buy-in, or it could be the way they were trained before. You know, they don't want to move into the curated model, and we might choose a different route for them, you know. So that analysis, that curated model, is already put in place in Living Health, and I think is only going to expand. We started with 8 or 10 most prevalent conditions, but it's going to expand beyond that.
Yeah, thank you for your questions. I want to leave a little bit of time for some other questions. I know we got one from Mark Maloney, who wanted to know about medical practices working within a value-based care model.
We have seen small primary care practices benefit from value-based care by participating in large IPAs and then sharing in some of the savings associated with a successful IPA program, and as well as ACOs. Do you think, Saurabh, that single specialty small practices will start to see that kind of upside, that kind of incentive to facilitate more value-based care participation? Or do you think that single specialty practices will die on the vine, so to speak, based on a shrinking fee-for-service marketplace?
I would opine, and this is just my opinion, Roy, I think there is going to be consolidation in this industry, and the single practice specialties will struggle to, you know, survive on their own and keep their economics intact. You know, if they go on the value-based care journey, they'll have to join hands with other like-minded providers. And because at the end of the day, value-based care's common thesis is reducing the cost of care while still continuing to provide highest quality of care. When you aim at reducing the cost of care, scale matters. So I think the single specialties will probably have to join hands with other like-minded providers and get on the VBR journey. Otherwise, it'll be very difficult for them to survive.
Yeah, you can sort of see directionally where the continuum is pointing. It's just while we travel down that continuum, you have different stages. Okay, Saurabh, I wanted to thank you very much for your time this morning. Really appreciate it. I know we all learned a great deal, and really sharing the experience that you've gathered across those incredible organizations is priceless. So thank you again, and I will follow up with you shortly.
Thank you, Roy, and thank you, everyone. You know, this is an incredible honor. And Roy, I want to thank the whole Scale Healthcare team. It's a fascinating organization with a lot of value-added topics. So thank you for inviting me, and look forward to further conversations.
Thank you. Thank you as well.